Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. There are plenty of things for us to talk about when we see some issues in the news, but the issue of parental rights is always one that catches my attention. And there are some big issues out there, some looming cases that really raise the issue of parental rights when it comes, for instance, not only to the right to make educational decisions for your children, the right to make parenting decisions about discipline regarding your children, Also, decisions about medical treatment. And I think when we get to this last one, that's where we all get a little bit queasy, because we recognize that there are some parents who fundamentally fail their children in terms of getting them adequate medical care. And sometimes that is complicated by the fact that they will make an argument that it's actually based upon their own religious beliefs. And I think just most of us would think that at some point, the need for the child to have medical attention and medical care trumps the parental rights, but let's admit it gets really, really difficult to imagine where that line is. Time Magazine's out with a very interesting article here. Dina Gutzer is writing about specific cases in which the children, they didn't fare well when they didn't get medical treatment, and as a matter of fact, some of them have died. And the big issue is when the state should step in, And when parental rights should be at least temporarily suspended. I think it's a good issue for Christians to think about in advance. And when you start thinking about some of the issues before us, just in terms of, well, the push for comprehensive sex education, I mean, how long is it before parents no longer have the say about some of the sexual decisions regarding their children? Let me just give you an example there. You've got school districts that are making decisions about what children will and will not hear regarding sex education. And there are cases now from both Massachusetts and California where parents are told you don't get to say what your child will or will not hear if they're in the public schools when it comes to sex education. What about when it comes to the child going to a comprehensive sex clinic in the high school, and regardless of parental inclinations or parental principles, that child has access to anything from contraceptive services to abortion? I think we really need to talk about how we think through the issue of parental rights, and we better think through exactly how we would answer someone who asks us the hard question, all right, where exactly do you draw the line? What's the difference between punishment and child abuse? What's the difference between a confident worldview in terms of the healing that God can provide and child abuse by risking the health and life of a child by withdrawing or withholding medical treatment? The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Folks, these issues are going to become more and more intense in coming days, because it's not just that medical technologies are raising new issues relating to the withholding of medical care, but it's because when it comes to the definition of medical care, for instance, it's covering a whole lot of things that you might not think of as medical. When you include the health of the child to encompass, mental health and well-being, not just physical health, well, that just opens the door for all kinds of people representing all kinds of purported professions to come in and say they know what's best for your child. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You can go and find us at Twitter, at twitter.com, and to go to Mohler Radio, we'll be having a discussion thread there as well. Other issues in the news are actually very, very interesting. One thing is getting some attention right now that ought to have certainly the ear of every evangelical Christian. That has to do with the fact that the New York Times is out with a story. Paul Vitello is the author, indicating that the Catholic Church is bringing back indulgences. If you have a little bit of historical understanding, you know that that was, in essence, the catalyst for the Reformation of the 16th century. Martin Luther, the reformer, was absolutely appalled by the fact that Johannes Tetzel, a Catholic agent was going through Germany selling plenary indulgences. He was selling indulgences. If you will buy this indulgence from the papacy, you'll be forgiven sins in purgatory, and you can do it in the name of your living or dead relatives as well and spring them from purgatory. The little marketing mantra that Tetzel was using was, as soon as the coin in the coffer rings, the soul from purgatory springs. And you would think that was just perhaps a part of medieval Catholicism left behind, but when the New York Times runs a story like this, it ought to have our attention. Here is the first paragraph. The announcement in church bulletins and on websites has been greeted with enthusiasm by some and wariness by others, but mainly it has gone over the heads of a vast generation of Roman Catholics who have no idea what it means. Here's the headline. Bishop announces plenary indulgences. In recent months, dioceses around the world have been offering Catholics a spiritual benefit that fell out of favor decades ago. The indulgence, a sort of amnesty from punishment in the afterlife, and reminding them of the church's clout in mitigating the wages of sin. Okay, that's fascinating right there. And if you're ever interested in where Catholic and evangelical theology part company, well, here it is, right here. Evangelicals do not believe that the church is given, quote, clout in mitigating the wages of sin. That is a Catholic doctrine, and they would root it in their reading in Matthew chapter 16, when Peter is given the power of the keys. But evangelical Christians see no such power there and instead see a grotesque contradiction to the gospel in both the notion of purgatory itself and in the idea that the church can sell the right to get out of purgatory early. There are some who are now suggesting that this is a part of a conservative turn in the Roman Catholic Church under the leadership of Pope Benedict XVI. I'll tell you, there's some fascinating things here. Let me just read you a couple of things that I came across here. It says here that the sale of indulgences, by the way, has appeared prominently in the website, the Diocese of Brooklyn, New York, which announced that any Catholic could receive an indulgence at any of six churches on any day or at dozens on more specific days, by fulfilling the basic requirements, which are going to confession, receiving Holy Communion, saying a prayer for the Pope, and achieving, quote, complete detachment from any inclination to sin. Okay, here's another problem. I'd like to meet the person who can achieve complete detachment from any inclination to sin. You know, that is the most self-deceptive formula in words I think I've ever seen. The moment you think that you have achieved complete detachment from any inclination to sin, you're sinning by thinking that you have achieved complete detachment from any inclination to sin. It's hilarious, if it were not so sad. Now, by the way, there have been people asking questions about why now? Why is this coming back and all the rest? One of my favorite statements about that is included in one of the men who is quoted in this, where someone says, why did it come back? And this person says, it came back because there's so much sin. Well, help me with this, but was there less sin a couple of years ago? What does this so much sin means? And to what degree do you actually believe that these indulgences mitigate sin? Folks, what we're looking at here is, again, a reminder that theology matters. A reminder that the differences between evangelicals and Roman Catholics in understanding the gospel, in understanding the way of salvation, in understanding the operation of grace, there are dramatic differences. The sale of indulgences coming back now in contemporary American culture is just a reminder that those differences are very, very deep. There are some liberal Catholic theologians, and as liberal Catholics, they reject so much that the Catholic Church teaches. They're embarrassed by this. The Reverend Richard P. McBrien, a professor of theology at the University of Notre Dame, says this, personally, I think we're beyond the time when indulgences mean very much. He went on to say, it's like trying to put the toothpaste back in the tube of original thought. Most Catholics in this country, if you tell them they can get a plenary that's a full indulgence, will shrug their shoulders. Well, that tells you a great deal. It tells you that there is no real consciousness of sin there. Otherwise, it would not be dismissed so casually. But it's also a misunderstanding of salvation. So we need to look at this and be reminded that theology always matters. And it's also healthy every once in a while to be reminded that theological controversies that have shaken the church for centuries seldom really go away. They sometimes go on some kind of quiet period of hold, but they very rarely actually go away. One of the issues that's not going away for the Church of England is whether or not it is going to consecrate women bishops. The logic of women bishops was absolutely included in their decision to ordain women as priests years ago. But now they're facing the fact that no matter which way they go, they're going to be splitting their church and making a lot of people very angry. The Church of England just opened its National Assembly on Monday. And that National Assembly is going to be confronted with draft legislation on allowing the consecration of women as bishops and other church matters. If that happens, you're going to see other churches in the Anglican Communion distance themselves even further from the Church of England. Just remember when you hear something like this, the churches worldwide that ordain women to the pastorate, much less to the episcopacy, to the role of bishop, they're a very thin slice of very wealthy, liberal Western churches. For most churches around the world, and for good reason, this is just inconceivable. We're going to come back to talk about the boundaries and foundations of parental rights in postmodern America on the Albert Mohler Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. I want to tell you why I think this issue is so important. It's because the edge of it is never where you think it is. We're talking about parental rights. Time magazine's out with a news story. The headline is, "When Parents Call God Instead of the Doctor." When you look at something like that, you can imagine immediately what the setup is. The setup is there are parents who believe in faith healing. Perhaps they are a part of a group such as Christian Science Movement that denies the reality of physical illness. Perhaps they're a part of some kind of positive thinking group. Perhaps they're part of a Christian sect that believes that medical care, medical intervention are wrong. You know the setup here. Children are denied medical treatment and they die. This news story starts out with Kara Newman. She was 11 years old. She had diabetes. She went into a diabetic depression here. It says here she suffered waves of nausea as she lay motionless on her deathbed, too weak to walk or speak. Kara's parents, both followers of the Unleavened Bread Ministries, an online church that shuns medical intervention, knelt in prayer beside their dying daughter. They did not call a doctor for help. A few hours later, Kara died of diabetes, a relatively common and treatable condition. Now, her parents, Dale and Leilani Newman, are being tried on criminal charges of the endangerment of a child, reckless endangerment of a child. If convicted, according to Time magazine, each faces up to 25 years in prison. In the prison, Unleavened Bread Ministries immediately released a statement saying the couple is being unfairly punished for quite... this is what it says, quote, "the crime of praying," end quote. Now, what you're looking at here is what I think most of us recognize is a hard case. Hard cases make bad law. They sometimes make bad moral argumentation. I'll be right here to tell you that I believe that parental rights should almost never, ever, ever be broken. Parental rights must be respected in almost every conceivable situation. I believe that parents have the God-given responsibility and not merely the right to act on behalf of their children so as to ensure their well-being. I believe that Christian parents have every right to do so on the basis of their very clearly demonstrated Christian convictions. But I think almost all of us would agree that when it comes to a child needing a blood transfusion, the convictions of Jehovah's Witnesses parents that would allow the child to die rather than have the blood transfusion will have to be put on hold. And those who believe in some kind of faith healing sect theology, they're going to have to be put on hold in terms of parental rights so that their children can survive. In this case, just a routine medical care for diabetes would have saved this girl. There are numerous other stories as well. A story about a 16-year-old boy in Oregon. His parents have been charged with criminally negligent homicide. He died from complications of a severely painful but easily treatable urinary tract infection. You know, this is hard stuff, and yet I don't think this is where the edge of the argument is. Let me tell you where I think the edge is. I think it's a lot closer to where most of us live than a child that is at the point of death. For instance, I've been hearing from parents, and perhaps you've seen some of this in the media, who are being told that they are in danger of losing their parental rights if they, for instance, do not allow their children to be vaccinated for certain diseases. And parents are already being denied parental authority over their children's decisions having to do with, anything from contraception to abortion in many settings. The current prevailing code of medical ethics says that adolescents have the right to an independent consultation with physician without parents either present or advised of what takes place in the conversation. A child as young as 12 or 13 years old could conceivably have a venereal disease, a sexually transmitted disease, and not allow the parent to understand it, to know it, to be advised of it. We're talking about here where parental rights in a postmodern age are being redefined before our eyes. And the problem is that if all we focus on is where there is literally a case of life and death, that's a pretty easy issue. I think at least it is for me. But where it isn't life or death, but it's really a moral or values question, that's where I think it gets a lot tougher. I'd be very interested in hearing from you what you're experiencing, what you're seeing, what you are hearing about out there, and frankly, how you would make the case for parental rights. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I think most parents know intuitively, instinctively, that it is our responsibility to make these decisions on behalf of our children. You know, after all, if the child needs a tonsillectomy, the doctor's not going to do it unless there is a parent ready to sign the permission and all the waivers and everything necessary. You have anything done in a hospital, let me tell you, there's form after form after form to sign, and on behalf of children, parents are doing the signing. But increasingly, the judgment's being made that parental rights have to be redefined on issues that aren't just about medical care or even just about sex education, but about discipline. And even about educational choice, there are those who are arguing that children ought to have the right to make their own educational decisions by the time they reach older grades, much less adolescence. Now, so far as I know, there's no particular case before the courts that's getting a lot of attention on those issues. There certainly are plenty of cases having to do with the medical care, and that's where you see them, for instance, in this Time magazine article. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let me just sketch out a case for parental rights for just a moment. Number one, let me just suggest to you a very simple, pragmatic test. This is not a deeply principled test first. This is a case that's basically just in the light of pragmatism. If parents aren't making these decisions, then someone else is. And just from an efficiency question, who in the world can more efficiently make this decision for children other than parents? If you don't have parents making this decision, you're going to have a huge core army of professionals ready to make these decisions. The late Philip Lash, writing about changes in American culture, spoke about the fact that the family has been stripped of so many of its functions by an army of professionals. Child care, child rearing experts, pediatricians, social workers, sociologists, educators, you name it. And now you have the reality that parents who know the child most intimately, love the child most closely as their own, and have the God-given responsibility to care for the child are being told, you don't know enough to make the decision in this area of life. That's a real threat to parental rights. Again, I think just from the pragmatic argument, it's hard for me to imagine that anyone actually believes that the federal government, the state government, a county government, any kind of governmental authority is better placed to make better and more efficient decisions about the welfare of children. But that's not even an argument based in principle yet. That one's coming. The more important argument is a principled argument. I just find it fascinating that even at the level of the pragmatic here, there isn't enough admission on the part of the bureaucrats that there's no way they could pull this off, even if they made it as their intention. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You know, it's interesting. When you look at where the controversies come here, it's almost always where the ideological issues are the hottest. So it's about biomedical ethics. It's about reproductive issues. It's about educational choice. This is where parenting in a postmodern age is getting more and more complicated. I'd love to hear from you as you're thinking about this, dealing with this. What's the case you would make for parental rights, and where would you draw the line? Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast and around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Listening to the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmueller.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. You're talking about issues of parental rights in postmodern America. As they say, the cutting edge is out there where perhaps many of us just don't see it. You know, there are, for instance, states and jurisdictions that are considering requiring vaccination for cervical cancer, the Gardasil vaccine. That's a sexually transmitted disease. Very interesting, very controversial, just to ask the governor of Texas in terms of that experiment. MSNBC is out with a news article. I have it right here in my hand. It says a 12-year-old girl was forced to take a pregnancy test at a school in Nevada City, California. It says here, and I'm reading from the article, MSNBC. It says the Pacific Justice Institute, which is representing the girl, said in a news release that Steve Davis, a counselor of Seven Hills Middle School, called the girl and pulled her out of class. He had heard rumors that the girl was pregnant and wanted to know if it was true. The girl denied it and told Davis, a classmate, had spread rumors about her in the past. The counselor got a pregnancy test from the school nurse and told the 12-year-old girl to give a urine sample. The pregnancy test was negative. The girl was embarrassed and humiliated. Her parents were angry. But at this point, the school is refusing even to apologize for this. So here you have a 12-year-old girl, 1, 2, that's 10 years old plus 2, who is forced into a pregnancy test in public school simply because a counselor heard she was pregnant and she said she wasn't. Again, parents, not involved here. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. There are plenty of people out there who would define for you how to raise your children, how to educate your children, how to discipline your children. And there are some who are willing to intervene. And before we draw an absolute line, I think, again, these cases of medical non-intervention are a warning to us that most of us would admit that at some point that becomes legitimate. Horribly, tortuously legitimate, but legitimate. But if we're not careful, that line is going to be on the wrong side of the equation. That's why we're having this conversation. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Beth's listening on WFIA. What do you think, Beth?
Hi, I'm driving in the rain. Thanks, Dr. Mueller, for taking my call.
Well, drive carefully, please.
Yeah, I am. I'm trying. I'm going to pull over here to talk. The point I wanted to make is there's a couple reasons I think this has happened. First of all, traditionally, any rights that a child had in the past came through the parent. I think that's changed now. I think now we have so many instances where children are no longer treated like children. They're treated like miniature adults. And that they are given adult responsibilities, yet they're still physically, socially, emotionally a child. I think that's part of it. The second thing I think has happened is that the mission of our schools has changed drastically in the last 50 years or so. And you have schools taking on the role of surrogate parent, as you said. You know, you've got the school that are making all sorts of decisions for how the child should be raised because there are so many parents that have vacated their roles as parents. Now, for those of us who want to raise our children, we have a lot of problem with an institution trying to reach out and tell our child, you know, what kind of food they're going to eat, if they're going to practice environmental stewardship, if they're allowed to take over-the-counter drugs or not. But the problem is that we are few and far between, and the school has had to step up to the plate and replace the parent in many ways, and in some cases even medicating the children.
Beth, I really appreciate your call. You're very articulate. You raise the issue in a way that makes us, and that's what's good about this kind of conversation, makes us take a little turn here and say, all right, there's another side to it. The other side to it is that there are many parents who do not fulfill their responsibility. Best point is that in that vacuum, the schools have, the way she put it, is that they have had to step in. You know, I would come back and say that's another symptom of what happens when you break down the cohesiveness of a culture and of a community to institutions like the school. It's a reduction of all of the bonds and relationships that should tie us together to the schools. And there's no doubt the schools have taken on these responsibilities. Schools have clinics for children. Schools have cafeterias for children. They're feeding children, doing medical care for children, and even taking care of child care for many children, because they will say, if we don't do it, no one else will. Beth says, for parents who do want to fulfill, are committed to fulfill parental responsibility, then that becomes more of a problem. I think it's, again, the whole question of what happens when you break apart the organic unity of a community where parents should hold each other accountable. And then you just turn and say, well, let's let the government do it. The state's always ready to step in. That's the nature of the government. The government's always ready to step in. The government's always ready to be given a new assignment and the money and the legal authority and the personnel to run somebody's life. And that's not just this government, just that state. That's the nature of political power in the Genesis 3 world. That's the way it works. But if parents are not vigilant, someone else is going to end up making the decisions we consider most important about our own children. Give me a call, 877-893-8255, and we'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I'm going to get to making that principled case for parental rights. First, we're going to go to Fred. Fred, what do you think?
Well, I just wanted to say that, you know, it's kind of a two-sided coin. I think the government not only needs to realize the importance of parental rights, but also the importance of parental responsibility. You know, parents just aren't being held accountable for their children's actions like they used to be.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to breaking down that web of relationships that would have meant for mutual accountability. Not perfectly. You know, in older, more intact cultures, it's never perfect. But, you know, parents used to be able to be pretty persuasive with each other, especially within Christian circles. And now, of course, you have to put with this zone of privacy that people claim for themselves, in which, you have no business entering into a discussion about how I raise my children. And, you know, within Christian circles, especially within the context of the local church, that's just fundamentally wrong. Okay, very quickly, let me make this principled case for parental rights. Just follow with me for a moment. The principled case for parental rights comes to the fact that God has given the institution of the family to us as an intact, tiny civilization, a proto-civilization. That is to say that the family, mother, father, and their offspring, both natural and adopted offspring, are a proto-civilization. They are what is necessary for larger civilization to thrive and to make any sense. The further you get from the organic, natural intimacy of the family, the more abstract problems become, the more theoretical and therapeutic concerns become, the more regulatory and legal issues become. Within the organic, natural context of the family, functioning as God intended the family to function, you have children cared for, you have children raised and disciplined, you have children protected and nurtured, you have the decisions being made by parents who are the God-ordained authorities who are the stewards of the lives of these children until the children reach the point where they can make responsible decisions on their own and then be responsible in terms of their own accountability. Now, that is a principled argument. That principled argument needs to be called into question when, for instance, you have parents who manifestly do not act in the well-being of their children. That's where, in cases of demonstrable abuse, parents forfeit what will be their natural right. I think that's the best way to look at it. They have a natural right. It's a God-given right. It's a right that's presumed. They don't have to earn that right. They're presumed to have that right. But they can forfeit that right if they neglect their children, if they abuse their children. Well, what about those who, for instance, would be a member of this kind of sect that would deny medical treatment? What about that? I think in a situation like that, the principled issue is to recognize that there are times in which the society has to step in for the best interest of the child, not with the goal, and here's the issue, not with the goal of separating the child from his or her parents, but with the goal of preserving the child's life such that there's a minimal compromise and collision between the interests of the child and parental rights, which is to say, the state doesn't have any business having an intention to remove children from the authority of their parents. The state has no business having any intention to step in as an in loco parentis parent in order to step in as a substitute for the parent. But the state, the community, the society, through legal mechanisms, might at times have to step in to avoid injury to a child, to avoid the neglect of a child, to prevent the death of a child. But the goal must always be to restore that family to its natural operations and to restore parents to their natural authority. You know, here's the deal. You will have a certain mindset that that people operate from in which they assume that parents earn the right. That, in other words, parents have to pass a certain test. You know, on this program, oh, it may have been 2 or 3 years ago, we actually talked about a proposal made in one jurisdiction, not in the United States, as I recall, that parents have to get a license to have a child. I don't know how that would be enforced, but even at the theoretical level, it's very interesting. Some people would say you have to be licensed. You have to prove your worthiness to be a parent. And, you know, when you see how so many parents are irresponsible, it can be seductive to think that way. Except when you start to look at it in context and understand that's totally destructive of the organic, natural unity of the family. You know, I think we need to be very, very clear that parents don't have to earn the right to be parents. Parents do not have to earn the right to exercise parental authority over their own children. Parents should be assumed and respected to have that right and to maintain that right until there is some clear and present danger to the child that is demonstrated. I think we have to be really, really careful that that would not include, for instance, when a parent says, I don't believe my daughter should have that that vaccine against a venereal disease. I don't think my child should have this educational course, but should rather have that one. I think we have to be very, very careful when routine biblical parental discipline is redefined as an incipient form of child abuse. You know, we're looking at a creeping bureaucratic displacement of the family. We're looking at this society, and Christopher Lash was exactly right, this society, Philip Reif also writing very similarly, this is a society that is stripping the family of its functions. We are outsourcing the functions. The feeding function will outsource to this. The medical function will outsource to that. The educational function will outsource over here. The expertise, well, we'll outsource that as well. The next thing you know, you have a family of experts. And Christopher Lash put this so brilliantly. He said there's a constellation of experts ready to march on every single home to instruct about how all things should be done. Very interestingly, by the way, there's been a book out a couple of years in which a good intellectual historian has traced all the different forms of absolutely emphatic parenting advice and shown how wildly the swings come in what's considered normative and normal in parenting. You know, you couldn't follow all that supposedly expert advice if you wanted to. The main case for us when it comes to parental rights is not established by just a legal declaration that parents have rights, but rather a biblical affirmation that parents are given this responsibility by the Creator. And if so, the first issue for us is not really parental rights. As important as those rights are, it is parental responsibility. Because ultimately, it is to God Himself we as parents will give an answer. Back with final thoughts. I'm Albert Mobley. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I'm going to shift to the subject here at the very end of the program today. I am very fascinated with an Associated Press story. It's out. Here's the headline. This will catch your attention. teens sexting a growing concern. This is spelled S-E-X-T-I-N-G. Here's the deal, and this is, well, let's just put it this way. When I was a teenager, I never had access to technology like this. It's hard for me to imagine if I did, I would think of doing what these kids are doing. But here's a growing phenomenon. Kids are taking what amount to pornographic pictures of themselves with their cell phones and sending it to other adolescent friends. And that is a federal crime of child pornography. Now, we were talking about parental rights. Let me tell you, one of the interesting things that comes up in this article is, for instance, you have some companies that are selling all kinds of monitoring software and all the rest, but the bottom line is that there is no software adequate to monitor photographs taken on a cell phone. So here is what this Associated Press article continues on to say. It says it could be part. Here is Terry Randall, an adolescent psychiatrist in Philadelphia. Now listen to this. Quote, it could be part of the contract of having a cell phone that you don't really get 100% privacy. It's just one more way of knowing what your kid is doing and where they are. Now, that's really fascinating. Okay? I would think if you're a parent, you had better be doing this. Not just that you might think of doing it or you ought to assert the right to do it. You know, I'll tell you, my parents didn't think I had any right to privacy when I was a teenager. And now with all this technology, I'm going to suggest there's even more reason for you as parents to make very clear that your teenagers do not have a zone of privacy. Their computer is your computer. Their cell phone is your cell phone. Their social networking accounts are yours. You have the management passwords. You have the ability to go in and look at everything. And my suggestion to you is if you're not doing it, you could be setting your own child up for disaster. If nothing else, your child or teenager, knowing that you intend to do this and will do it periodically, that might be just the firewall that child or teenager needs to make a better rather than a worse decision on issues of this kind of importance. You know, you look at this and you say, my kid would never do that. Well, that's certainly the way I would normally think as well. But let's just remember, you put that kind of technology unprecedented in human history, in the hands of a teenager or a kid who on a dare might do just about anything. Yeah, you need to be checking this stuff really, really carefully. The stakes could be very high. You know, some of these kids are being charged with child pornography. And that is and should be the kind of crime that that follows one for a lifetime. You're looking here at, again, parenting in a postmodern age. Who knew to expect that sexting would be something parents would have to talk about? You can find that article by looking at Associated Press. You'll find it probably in a good many newspapers, and if you don't pay attention, you might find it on your doorstep as well. Back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. I'll meet you for Intelligent Christian Conversation on the Albert Miller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.